record button here. Looks like we should be good. Okay, so this is Silke Schmidt interviewing Bill Sugden for part three of the UW Archives Oral History Project. Today is December 12th, 2016. One quick clarification. You talked last time about the Czech scientist who was helped by Howard, mm-hmm. and somehow we never got around to mentioning his name. Is it Jan Svoboda?
It is. So
okay. Okay, I googled a bit and that certainly sounded yes. Czech, and I figured that was him. Okay, thank
absolutely
you.
Absolutely delightful person.
Okay.
So he stayed with us.
Okay.
That's a delightful guy.
Okay, yeah. Good. So just a few more questions back to Howard, and before we then kind of pick up where we left off with your own work, who was the driving force behind naming the Lakeshore Path after him? Somehow I didn't get around to asking that. Was it his wife primarily, or folks from this department, or...
Probably all of the above, but I also think the chancellor at that time.
Okay.
So it was a combination of wanting to recognize him and then the appreciation that that's a path they took every day and that that would be particularly appropriate. So I imagine the combination, certainly Rayla contributed to that identification too.
Right. Okay. And so the people that helped make that happen, who were his other close friends in the department besides yourself?
Bill Dove, who is just two down from me at that time. Who else would have been influential? Well, Henry Pito, for sure. And so this would be 94. Henry would have been chair at that time, so he would have been quite influential. Probably, I'm trying to make sure that Jim was certainly alive. Betty was probably the Millers, too. All of
the Millers, but, okay.
Yeah. A lot of people.
A lot of people. Yes. Okay. And I think you told me that he knew other Nobel laureates. Did you know people like Josh Lederberg and his wife? Or
who were here?
Yeah.
I knew
I think
quite
they
a
were...
few from other parts of my own life, but I did not know them here. They had moved by that time, but Rayla and Howard certainly knew the Lederbergs, and they knew Corona. But I did not.
You did not know those. Okay, alrighty. And then none of his daughters actually went to UW for college or grad school, correct? They both went elsewhere. Okay, alright. Okay, well, let's get back to your work. So we talked quite a bit about your research. I have just a couple more questions about that and then something more broadly about UW and teaching, as you just mentioned. So what would you say, it sounds like you and others have learned so much about EBV in the past 40 years. So I was wondering what has enabled some of the biggest insights, like technology, a lot has happened in molecular genetics, to be sure, insights from studies of other viruses, perhaps epidemiology to some extent. I mean, what were the key I'm sure everything is learned, like each year brings some progress, but, in terms of the bigger milestones, what would you say would enable those?
Well, it's fun that you ask the question, because something that Howard and I used to debate is whether science drives technology or the other way around. And there's no answer. So many things have made it easier to work with EBV. One of them was something that I was involved in very early on, was what you would call recombinant DNA technology. Just the ability to isolate purified pieces of DNA and characterize what they do. So here's a thought. Virology, I'm going to sneeze, is not so popular these days, because you can do so much more with the intact cell or with tissue than you used to be able to do. What made virology popular and powerful was that early on you could purify, because the virus did it for you, a piece of nucleic acid, a few genes, and then study them in detail. Well, what was peculiarly difficult about Epstein-Barr virus early on is it was big for a virus, and that you couldn't grow it. So there were two hurdles that we had to overcome. And being able to clone the DNA and then take fragments of it and study them as the basis of individual genes of the virus and what they do was an amazing advance. That was not done in a day. That was done over, say, a decade that we really began to be able to study it. And part of it was just sequencing. So here's, for me, a lovely memory. There were some labs that
early on in DNA sequencing, we're sequencing 1,000 base pairs of EBV or 5,000 base pairs and publishing it. And they would do everything one could conceivably think of in those days with that 1 or 5 kilobase pairs information. And so by the time it was published, it was useful, but not something that you would want to pursue immediately. And a few of such papers were out. So in 1983, 84, something like that, this huge package came in the mail. And it was a tape. And that literally was a tape that about, so, 10 inches in diameter. And it was sent by the people in Cambridge, England, who had decided that this was the biggest piece of DNA they could get their hands on, and it was the entire sequence. And they sent it to everybody who had, was at that moment working on EBV, at least whom they knew. And so, speaking about manna from heaven, woohoo! This was it. And just that information then allowed us to ask questions that we could not have asked before. So that's an example of technology driving the kinds of science that became possible. And it was quite remarkable because prior to that time, we were looking for and thought we had found what is, I'm going to say, the origin of DNA synthesis of EBV. Mm-hmm. So both in the human genome, in mammalian genomes, and in viruses, DNA viruses, there are discrete sites at which the initiation of DNA synthesis takes place. And it's not then extended on forever. There are subsequent sites at which it can initiate. But for EBV plasmids, there's one. And we wanted to find that because it would then become a tool to identify what other viral genes were necessary for it to function. Because we knew nothing. But we knew it was a plasmid. We'd shown that. People in Sweden had shown it. So it had to have some way of persisting independent of the chromosome. It had to have an origin of DNA synthesis. Mm-hmm. So we were really rather sure we'd narrow down where it was. This sequence lands in our lap, and we could immediately go and look to see that at that region what the sequence was. And the sequence was peculiar and distinct from anything else in the genome and smelled as if, yes, that made sense. So it was a lovely gift. And the people in England really made a great advance that way. Other advances have come from immunology because EBV infects B cells, those cells that make antibodies. It's been studied for a number of years by immunologists to ask questions related to pathology but also related to other facets of what EBV can do. So then that information flows into the molecular biologists and vice versa. There's been a lot that I've gleaned anyway, I'm not sure other folks have so much, but from the epidemiology. Mm-hmm. And that's just fascinating to try to understand. I mean, crudely, why do kids in Africa get Burkitt's lymphoma and we tend not to? Well, there's understanding that has been made possible through the epidemiology, through the realization that malaria is a cofactor. And then that feeds into the immunology that has been done to study EBV and the diseases with which it's associated to realize that really our immune system is quite good at limiting EBV infection. It doesn't eliminate it, it limits it. And it's when that limitation is itself inhibited either by disease or by genetics that you get tumors. So all of that, information has flown from many sources over the 43 years I've worked with it,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
which also makes it a rich thing to work on, definitely.
Right, right. So you actually just alluded to this a little bit. So a pretty large number of people are infected with viruses like EBV and also HPV, which we talked a little bit
mm-hmm.
about, but they don't come down with cancer.
Right.
So
why? Thinking, can I even answer that for HPV?
If you can, then
I can. Let me answer for HPV briefly, and then
okay.
given my monomaniacal view, enlarge on for Epstein-Barr virus. For HPV, first, there are about 150 different. They're called serotypes, but what that really means is that these are related viruses. Each is distinct, however, in sequence. So they share some sequence, but they differ in other regions. And it's only a rather small subset that's associated with disease in people. What distinguishes that subset is that the genes that do contribute to cancer in those people who get the subsets that with tumorigenic HPV are modified. They are not carcinogenic, let's say, in the vast majority of subtypes of human papillomaviruses. Then, if you do happen to get infected with, say, HPV 16 or 18, it's by no means certain that you're going to come down with cancer. Probably what matters is the virus is maintained as a plasmid, as its EBV, but it has to get integrated. It has to get integrated into the chromosome, because upon integration, if it is integrated in the wrong way for us, but the right way for the tumor, then some of the genes that can drive tumorigenesis will be expressed far more efficiently. So mm-hmm. that's a chance event.
Okay.
That cell then has to acquire additional mutations without which it will not become a tumor. That's a chance event.
Mm-hmm.
So the chances are you've got to get infected with the wrong subtype of HPVs. It does have to integrate. That's a rare event. It has to integrate in a particular fashion. That's a rare event. And then additional mutations in that cell must occur over time. That's a rare event.
Okay.
And still, a lot of people get it.
Right.
But there are a lot of people out there, and a lot of us are infected.
Right.
So,
okay.
That's HPV.
That's
for EBV.
HPV.
many more of us are infected with EBV. And right now, I think there's no reason to think that there are strain differences in which some strains are markedly more predisposed to cause cancer than others. There clearly are differences at the sequence level. There are roughly two flavors of EBV you can tell biologically and by sequence, but even between them or within those that are related to those two types, all of them can be found in cancers.
Mm-hmm.
There are two kinds of cancers, roughly, those that are lymphoid B-cell types and those that are epithelial, things like nasopharyngeal carcinoma, some gastric carcinoma. Carcinoma means tumor of an epithelial origin.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier to say what's necessary for a EBV positive lymphoma to arise. There, the virus induces and can maintain proliferation of the infected cell. The immune response will recognize that cell as being foreign because there are foreign proteins being expressed
mm-hmm.
and kills it. A small subset of cells survives that have actually withdrawn from the cell cycle, so they're not proliferating. They're called memory B cells. They have EBV in them as a plasmid, and they stick around in your blood and my blood for all of our lives.
Hmm.
With some frequency, and we don't know what that frequency is, those cells convert for reasons we do not understand and become proliferating again, and they probably release virus. And that virus is going to then stay with us for the rest of our lives. We will, once those cells are proliferating, they're going to be killed by our immune response, but what we're doing is stimulating our immune response all the time,
mm-hmm.
so that we're going to get exposed to EBV for sure, multiple times throughout the rest of our lives. But in general, we don't come down with disease.
Mm-hmm.
We do come down with disease if we're immunosuppressed or immunocompromised. And some diseases do that. And it's done, here's a word I can never pronounce, iatrogenically, I think it's the right word, which means clinically by mistake, roughly speaking.
Okay.
You know, if you go in and you have a kidney transplant, you have to get immunosuppressed, and then
mm-hmm.
if you have EBV-infected cells, which almost certainly you do,
mm-hmm.
they can evolve into lymphomas. So what's happening? Well, when you inhibit the immune response and you have cells in you that are infected with EBV, they proliferate. And they acquire mutations. The kinds of mutations, we know a lot about what those mutations are. So for example, a very common mutation that's acquired, which doesn't mean that its formation is common. It's just, it provides such a selective advantage so that rarely when it happens you get to see it. And what that mutation is it takes a known cellular oncogene called MYC, and it juxtaposes it to the immunoglobulin locus. So in B cells, immunoglobulins, antibody genes, are expressed very efficiently. So if you bring together a cellular proto-oncogene, that's a Howard Tenen term,
mm-hmm.
proto-oncogene, to a region that is efficiently expressed, you make a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out, by the way, you don't really make so much MYC in these tumors. What you do is you make it all the time. So c-MYC is a gene which is expressed episodically in a very controlled manner.
Mm.
In this case, it's just expressed constitutively.
Okay.
And that probably is a driving force to keep the cell proliferating.
Mm-hmm.
What happens then over time is, again, these cells are still subject to an immune response, even if it's immunocompromised. So that if it occurs in an immunocompromised host, so that those cells don't fare well, they tend to be killed as far as one knows. On the other hand, if they have additional mutations in them that allow the diminished expression of the viral genes, which really are the signals to the immune system, kill me,
mm-hmm.
then those cells escape whatever residual immunity is there, and they form a tumor.
Okay.
What is amazing to imagine, and I don't understand this at all, is it's kids who get Burkitt's lymphoma. You and I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can get some rare tumors associated with EBV and B cells, diffuse large B cell lymphomas. A fraction of them are EBV positive. But why is it only children that come down with bona fide
mm-hmm.
Burkitt's lymphoma? I don't know.
Hmm.
And that's a question I've tried to pose both to myself and to many other people, and I have no answer.
Wow, that's interesting. Yeah, you said it's typically like 4 to 7 year olds?
Yeah, so it's, I mean, the reason it won't be younger is pretty easy to guess, and that is that moms have, they're all, you know, roughly all of us, including all moms, have been infected with EBV, so they have neutralizing antibodies that will prevent infection.
Mm-hmm.
So if you try to take the blood of a one-year-old or two-year-old, you're going to find out they're not going to be EBV positive, but they will have detectable antibodies of the IgM class.
Mm-hmm.
That's what crosses the placenta to EBV antigens. Presumably, that's going to limit infection.
Okay.
That wanes as the child grows. It's probably present in breast milk too, so it'll depend on whether
mm-hmm.
the kids are breastfed.
Mm-hmm.
But by 2 or 3 years of age, there's much less of that. So
mm-hmm.
now they're going to be much more likely to be infected. And as long as you live in poor countries, in which I don't know if I said this, poverty in this means how many people live per square foot of housing space.
Mm-hmm.
You get enough of them, then you get all these communicable diseases or communicable viruses, et cetera, passed to young people very rapidly. And that's when EBV is going to get passed. And so then you pick up, and you don't see primary infection, in fact, ever. You see that in teenagers, but that only happens in wealthy countries.
Mm-hmm.
But primary infection early on is not noticed unless it then within, let's say I calculated, 9 to 24 months later, you can see Burkitt's lymphoma.
Okay.
So it's not immediate. There again,
right.
all these things that I've described
right.
have to evolve to happen. But from prospective studies,
mm-hmm.
it's at least 9 months. It can be several years.
Okay. Okay.
After infection, do you see the disease?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so you have a good explanation for why it's not earlier, and then why do you think it ends at?
I can't fathom.
That.
I mean, in that part of it. Well, let me say something that's part of an answer, but it's surely not a whole answer. Part of the answer would be that children in Central Africa and New Guinea who are destined potentially to develop Burkitt's lymphoma are all positive, and they've all survived whatever period of being immunocompromised in the presence of the virus has occurred by the time they're teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense that you either get it or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But then why doesn't it evolve later, or why don't we get it? And that I don't understand. I don't understand why it doesn't come up sporadically in us. Why, and in some funny way it does. So let me give two answers to that. People who have HIV come down with Burkitt's lymphoma
mm-hmm.
for sure at later in life. So what makes Burkitt's lymphoma? Well, it's really what the pathologist calls it. So it's a lymphoma which has what is called a starry sky pattern when it's stained. Mm. What that means is it's a lymphoma with lots of proliferating cells and lots of macrophages. The macrophages are making the starry sky pattern. So you could imagine there are other forms that B-cell lymphomas take with EBV being a driving force, but they haven't been identified except for this fraction of diffuse large B-cell lymphomas. So there's a lot about it that I can wave my hands until I blew my face. I don't understand it, honestly.
Okay. All right, so then last time you also said that there is both a treatment for Burkitt's lymphoma that is possible in principle and an EBV vaccine, but there's sort of significant practical hurdles. Last time. Is there a chance of overcoming these obstacles as time goes on? And
oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So.
So, do you want me to elaborate?
Sure.
Okay. So, I'm not sure exactly to what you're referring, but I can say the kind of treatment that exists, the kind of treatments I hope for. How can I do all that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The kind that exists is it's treated as are all lymphomas by chemotherapy. So lymphomas are localized in space. You might have them in the lymph nodes here and under the jaw. So you could imagine treating them with radiation. They're very radiation sensitive. The problem with that is by the time you've seen them, often they will have metastasized elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So they're almost always going to be treated with chemotherapy. In this society, particularly if your children develop it, they can be followed in academic hospitals or just any really very good hospital. And treatment can be very successful.
Right.
It's quite tough on the kid, but it's very successful.
In this country, right?
In this country.
I think you're saying that we don't have it yet in Africa.
No, and there's no way, given this kind of, right. It's not going to be practical in any rural setting, be it in Africa or elsewhere, but it's Africa where it's most common.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, as much as I want to focus on EBV, it's far more important right now to get rid of HIV there because many more people are dying of it than of EBV.
Mm-hmm.
And they could die of Burkitt's lymphoma, but they also have HIV infection.
Right.
So the two ways that I can envision developing practical therapies inexpensively or preventions inexpensively for the world are, one, the way that we're trying to do it. So roughly speaking, what we know is through work we've done that Epstein-Barr virus provides lymphoma's selective advantages. That if you force the loss of the plasmid, the DNA from those cells die by a programmed cell death.
Mm-hmm.
We know that. So we've then turned to ask, how can we rid the tumor cell of the EBV plasmid? And we know, we've studied the mechanism of the synthesis of this DNA and how it gets distributed to daughter cells,
mm-hmm.
since we identified all that in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a single viral protein that's essential for this synthesis and partitioning called Epstein-Barr virus nuclear antigen 1, EBNA1 for short, and we've learned how to inhibit it in the lab. That inhibition actually requires just using a fragment of that protein to inhibit the intact protein, and it works very well,
mm-hmm.
and the cells die.
Right.
But we can't do that in a person, and we certainly can't do that efficiently in a child in Central Africa. So what we've been doing is to look for small molecules that a person could take as a drug that would accomplish the same end as this piece of EBV, of EBNA1, excuse me. And we've been supported a little bit by the university and much more so by the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society,
mm-hmm.
and screened some 410,000 molecules.
Okay.
And have found several that certainly could not be drugs, but may constitute the beginning of a lead that then, through a lot of medicinal chemistry, could be refined to have higher potency and higher specificity. And we have to make sure it doesn't have ancillary properties that would be lethal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're trying to do.
Okay. So there is a clear path.
Yeah, there's a path.
Like, I mean.
Honestly, the biggest hurdles we face are now just funding, because the federal government won't fund this kind of fishing expedition. And there's no way we'll ever get to have it. We here will get to have a drug. But if we could get it to the point where companies would find it sufficiently tantalizing to pursue, then we might be able to have, and I mean, I'm not in this for profit. They
mm-hmm.
can take it, if,
mm-hmm.
so long as they're going to invest all of the work necessary to make it become practical.
Okay.
And we might be able to get help at that level through NIH or things like the Gates Foundation.
Mm,
so
okay.
those are
right.
my
right.
junctions.
Sure.
Now they're fantasies, but that's where
yeah.
I love to go.
Okay.
The second way is a vaccine. And have I not talked about this?
A little bit. It just it also sounded like, so you said, from what I remember, you were talking about chickenpox.
Yes,
and
exactly.
that you could get make a hybrid vaccine.
Exactly.
That you could, because the chickenpox vaccine works,
yes.
and even though it's live, attenuated. Because you said for herpes viruses, the dead
don't work
at all.
Work
right,
at all.
So we did talk about that. And you said chickenpox and then hybrid, getting some of the proteins from EBV into it. But then it sounded like, you were saying again that it can't really be tested. It's not
that's the problem.
Feasible.
So,
and so I was wondering, is that just a dead end that's never going to be
overcome? No, it's not a dead end.
Overcome?
But what it requires is someone who's willing not only to invest his or her time in it, but has the position, the authority to do so.
Okay.
So let me give an example. Maybe 20, 25 years ago, it became practical to make a vaccine for human papillomaviruses,
right.
and there was the need. That's just a protein, and
right.
that came out of understanding how the capsid of that protein is assembled, what's minimally necessary, and then you could do it in yeast, for example, or
mm-hmm.
E. coli. The hard part was then how do you test this thing?
Right.
And I know of one test, there have been more than one, but I don't know of one. And that was actually carried out by NIH, which
mm-hmm.
is an amazing thing to think of because they don't normally test vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
But someone whose name is Alan Hildesheim, who I've gotten to know and is just a lovely person, had set up in Costa Rica many, many years before a series of studies of, don't think it was cervical carcinoma, but something where it was for women in particular.
Hmm.
So it was an epidemiologic study.
Okay.
And over the decades became sufficiently close to all the people whom he was studying, helping,
okay.
That when he went and broached them with the idea, would they by this time had children, they had
mm-hmm.
daughters,
mm-hmm.
would they want to participate in this vaccine trial? That they had a tremendous compliance.
Hmm.
And it worked. I mean, they could, the end point for that wasn't the prevention of cervical carcinoma, it was prevention of infection,
mm-hmm.
because that's the only thing. I mean, you have to wait too long for the,
right.
to know about the cervical carcinoma.
Right.
And what you would need is the resources that Alan had at his disposal, which was NIH with funding,
mm.
and then a large cohort of people who were trusting.
Trust, right. Trust, it sounds like, was a big
right.
word, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that's not me. I don't have the resources, and I don't, and that's a, and it's a lot of work. I mean,
right.
it just doesn't happen.
Right.
But it, so, as much as in my fantasies I'd love to do that, I know I can't.
Mm-hmm.
Can somebody else? Sure.
Okay.
But in the interim, and by the way, that would still take decades to implement. I'm going to long since be dead by then,
mm-hmm.
honestly. In the interim, I'm going to try to get to the point where we have, if we're lucky, leads that can be pursued for small molecule inhibitors.
Okay.
So.
Okay. And what was the name, Alan?
Alan Hildesheim.
Hildesheim.
Who is
at
NIH also.
At NIH, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Extraordinarily nice person.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good, because that was one thing I was left wondering. It sounded like there's so many hurdles. I was like, well, can we ever overcome the hurdles? But it sounds like we can. It'll just take
yes.
time and
the appropriate resources
and people
exactly.
and the trust. Yeah, okay.
And by the way, it makes sense. I mean, it's much better to prevent something than to try to treat it.
Treat it, right.
But think of, you know, here's a great example. How long have we had the polio vaccine? And we still have not eliminated
right,
polio.
Right.
And that's part political. It's
mm-hmm.
part bad luck, it's, but,
mm-hmm.
so once it leaves the lab, there are a lot of other things that are necessary to make something work, and
right.
most people in the labs aren't in the position to do so,
right.
honestly.
Right,
yeah.
Right, okay. All right, so then your focus is obviously cancer research, but so EBV has also been studied in other diseases such as multiple sclerosis. Have those findings informed your own work? I mean, have you tried to keep up with what people are finding for EBV and MS?
Oh,
I just started because that's such a whole. Now that you talk a little bit about immunology, but you know that there's cancer and then there's
sure,
a lot of other diseases, and how much can you really keep up with, right? In a 40-hour or 60-hour whatever work week.
So let me try to say it another way. Intellectually, everything you said is true, and there's no way I can keep up in details on the details of any of this, or of much of it. But when I first began working on EBV, very few people worked on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I recognized that my ability to continue to work on it in part reflected the world's interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to find a lot of folks working on blue-green algae, but biologically, it could be every bit as interesting in the abstract as
mm-hmm.
Epstein-Barr virus, maybe much more so.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted, and I worked early on to try to make it more tractable to work on and to provide some information about it that would be more extend to a larger community than those who work on EBV per se.
Okay.
So, and you know, it's not like I had this plan when I came here. It's
mm-hmm.
just as I was
mm-hmm.
here, I realized this would be advantageous if we can do it. So not only did we work to understand how EBV DNA is synthesized and distributed to daughter cells, but we made derivatives of them that then could be used by people and companies the world over to introduce genes into all human cells and
mm-hmm.
maintain them as plasmids. So it's been used in gene therapy, it's been used in labs everywhere. Now, did that make me a better scientist? Hell no. But what it did do is, to a very small extent, spread the faith, get more people knowing about it, get more people potentially interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essential to have the work we do be recognized, but also to have a community who cares.
Mm-hmm.
If you have enough people working on a project, it's going to move forward faster than
mm-hmm.
if it's an isolated group.
Right.
I mean, the biggest example of that is HIV.
Mm-hmm.
Almost nothing in virology today is going to be as powerful as anything you learn about HIV, because so many people work on it. So much of what we learn in biology has come from what people have learned first about HIV.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's intrinsically interesting? No, because it's a horrible pathogen and people poured money into the research,
mm-hmm.
honestly.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, to the extent that we can do that for EBV, you want to. And we're not going to do it the way HIV is done, but anyway, that's
mm-hmm.
been a driving force too.
Mm-hmm.
That's a long way to answer, to say something else that, you know, if I could, I would, I want to make the world better.
Mm-hmm.
MS, when I taught courses on MS when I was first here, MS is very common in northern parts of the world,
mm-hmm.
and particularly back in the 80s when I taught these courses, it was just an enigma, and it remains a bit of an enigma still. But the idea that there was a viral association with MS came from maybe even the 70s, the 80s, when people realized that if you came from northern British Isles, you had something like a 1% chance of developing MS, and I'm going to be approximate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you moved before puberty to Israel, that dropped to whatever the prevailing low risk of developing MS was,
mm-hmm.
Consistent with the idea that there were infectious diseases that correlated with, and that you got infected early in life or later in life,
mm-hmm.
That correlated with the incidence of MS. And there were a lot of these sort of odd studies.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that, I think anybody who's read about MS from my peculiar position would have thought that viruses could contribute to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then people have screened for what those viruses might be. And it's not that the virus per se, in the current model, which is by no means certain,
mm-hmm.
it's not that EBV per se is doing something to cells in the central nervous system. Rather, it's providing antigens that are recognized by the immune response, and those antigens are sufficiently let's say, cross-reactive with things in the central nervous system, that that cross-reactivity could lead to what is thought to lead to MS.
Okay.
It is by no means certain,
mm-hmm.
and as I wrote in one review, the only way you're ever going to know that for sure is you get rid of EBV. If you
mm-hmm.
also get rid of MS, fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we don't know if one
right.
is really directly causal for the other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I do read about it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, you look, you know, I'm in a university. The people who are in this lab and go on and do science shouldn't do what I do because, you know, it will have been done, kind of.
Yeah.
So providing these sorts of correlative studies, I mean, they correlate with what we study here, but they're distinct, is an impetus for them to read more widely, to think more widely.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be better scientists if they do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always easy to get people to, you know, reach out to quite different
right,
subject matter.
Right. Okay. Let's see. So what do you think it will take to develop an AIDS vaccine? And so, like, somebody once referred to the childhood vaccines that we've had for quite a while now, to the low-hanging fruit. And so cancer vaccines are obviously much harder.
Mm-hmm.
I guess HIV vaccines are
much
at least as hard, maybe harder still than the cancer vaccines.
Oh, yeah.
Is it? Can you describe in any way, like, why?
Sure.
It's
and
much
again,
harder.
There are several reasons why vaccines for HIV haven't been generated successfully. So one of them is, I think most of the time the people aren't infected with a virus, they're infected with cells.
Mm-hmm.
And the cells then are going to disseminate in the body and release virus for some limited period of time. So it's not as if you have, let's see, what sort of examples can I give? Well, you know, influenza you're going to get through the oral mucosa. And you've got to stop it, you have to stop that, either the cells that initially get infected, you have to kill them. And if it gets out of those cells, then you have to neutralize the virus with probably with antibody in the bloodstream very rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not getting into us as in a cell where that cell persists for some period of time, releasing virus for some period of time, and it won't be one cell, it'll be a handful, and I don't
mm-hmm.
know how many. So I think the initial inoculum of virus that could get into us would be harder to limit than for many infectious diseases. That's one. Two, once it makes it into one of our CD4 positive T cells, then it gets amplified. You have to kill that cell or really pretty much get rid of every damn virus that that cell releases, and it's going to release it for a few days
mm-hmm.
Because other cells in the vicinity get infected. So I think that the difficulty is that there's so little room for escape
mm-hmm.
in this disease. I mean, do I know more than that? I guess I don't know more than that. What is the real failure for most of the vaccines that have been tested? I mean, one thing that is clear, but this is going to be true for a lot of RNA viruses, and HIV has this intermediate RNA life. I mean, it's an RNA
okay.
DNA virus.
Okay.
Is that when you use RNA as a template, the enzymes that do that are really error-prone. So you're going to throw off lots of mutations.
Right, I think you do. Yeah,
yeah.
The high mutation rate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's
yeah.
a very high mutation rate. But on the other hand, that's not going to hurt us unless it gets a chance to proliferate and give rise to many cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're going to pick up mutations. And most of what has hindered vaccines, people claim in the literature, is this high mutation rate gives rise to variants that are resistant to any of the initial immune response that's
mm-hmm.
elicited by a vaccine. But somehow that doesn't, I mean, I'm sure all that's correct, but why aren't the initial variants, the initial virus that comes in, stopped, and they're not?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I harp on this idea that it's a cell that brings
okay.
it in.
Okay.
And I think there's really good data that that's usually the case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But obviously, if I really need the answer, I'd try to work on that.
Right.
Right. That's a really important issue. People, one, I'm sure I mentioned John Coffin.
John Coffin, yes.
Yeah,
he's
as knowledgeable as anybody on that subject, period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Very sharp guy.
Right, right. And do you think there'll be other cancer vaccines like HPV?
No, not like, I mean, there could be one for EBV someday, not
right.
in my lifetime, but
right.
sometime. No, because it's only about 15, maximally 20% of the human cancers are caused by infectious agents.
Mm-hmm.
Those that are, I think, yes, you can
they
be able
are.
To eliminate
mm-hmm.
the infectious agent. But for the other 80%,
mm-hmm.
it's a combination of genetics and spontaneous mutation during our lifetime that gives rise to something that really is a cancer.
Right.
You know, if you think about the number of tumors that arise during reproductive age, they're not many. But if you look at the incidence, it goes up with an exponent of about the fifth or sixth power of age.
Mm-hmm.
So the older you are, whew, the frequency
yeah.
goes up.
Right.
And I point that out just to say, really, the selection to prevent or avoid cancers really doesn't occur in us. And so this is not only a disease of the elderly, it's a disease that has really escaped much of the power of selection and evolution because
mm-hmm.
it occurs after we reproduce.
Right.
So.
Right. Okay.
On average. I mean,
mm-hmm.
kids get it too.
Yeah.
It's lymphoma,
right.
but it's rare.
Right. Right. Okay. Now, so mentees, we haven't talked about that at all. You mentioned quite a few of Howard's, but who are some of your mentees that you're particularly proud of and where are they
well,
today?
I can answer that, but let me preface it by saying, these folks are an extended family, and you really can't have favorites among your children. It's not fair.
That's
but,
true,
you know,
yeah.
But
yeah.
I can say where a lot of them are. I can just go historically. They're the first two who were in the lab. Willie, Mark, joined, I guess, first, Chris Kittner next, and Willie was last, and I think he's pretty much retired now, at Cornell Medical running their animal facilities. Before that, he was at Sloan Kettering running their animal facilities. Before that, he was a faculty member in Cornell,
okay.
Ithaca. Chris is at the Salk. He's also a professor at University of California in San Diego. So
okay.
That's the closest one. And I've been closer to Chris because why? Well, this is a lovely story. He's a very fine experimentalist. And at some point, towards maybe the last 2 years of his being a graduate student with me, Donata, my spouse, was trying to make brain slices work.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris, maybe we had journal clubs together, I'm not sure. But then Chris started working a day a week with her.
Mm-hmm.
And he was instrumental in making, the two of them did it together, but making this preparation be useful. So that he knows both of us well. And then he went and postdoced with someone at Caltech who then left Caltech and went to England, Jeremy Brocks by name. And we must have visited him in England, so Chris went with him. We visited him in England and then met his wife-to-be, and then I went, who's German?
Okay.
It's Donata. Donata, my wife, was born in Germany. And so I went to his wedding in Germany. Anyway, we've had a lot of
uh-huh.
communication
sure.
since, I guess, he graduated in 1981.
81, wow, okay.
Yeah. And he's a very accomplished scientist.
Okay.
In a lot of ways.
Okay. So this was Chris. What was his last name?
Kittner. Kintner. And
okay.
by the way, his family at that time was in Wisconsin, so he was a Wisconsinite.
Okay.
Very nice person. After Chris, who else came? Two people, graduate students. One is must be one of the more unlucky human beings I know, and his name is Stan Metzenberg. His father was a faculty member here, so he too was from Madison. He was from Madison, also from Wisconsin. And Aida was another graduate student. They were, I mean, husband and wife before they left. She was in genetics. So she's come down with MS.
Oh.
They have two children, one of whom is autistic in the extreme.
Oh,
and Stan wrote within the last few months he has been diagnosed with a sarcoma.
Wow. It's a lot for one family.
Yeah.
Jeez.
So incredibly unlucky.
Yeah.
And he and I didn't get along.
Okay.
When he was here. And that was actually, that was resolved quite beautifully by Howard. And I think Stan wouldn't have gotten along with any authority figure because he had problems with his dad, who was a professor here.
Oh.
And the way we resolved all of that is that although he formerly worked under my direction, in fact, he moved out of the lab for a year and worked in Jeff Ross's lab. And that seemed to make things work out fine. And the other thing I did is I said, look, Stan, you be the author in your papers. I'll help you write them all, but I'm not going to be an author on them. This is your work. And that's the way we did it. So that was just fine. And he did beautiful work, too. But I actually think we're reasonably close now. So when I'm no longer the authority figure, it's okay. But I do, boy, has he had a hard time. Vijay Baishwal was there about that same time. So Vijay transferred from, I think, Purdue. He got a master's there and came here. He's from India. Very different kind of personality than Stan's. He eventually went to work for a company. He went as a postdoc in Berkeley and then went and worked for a company there,
mm-hmm.
and wasn't so happy, and now works for a company in Utah. He lives in southern San Francisco, or just south of San Francisco, so he flies there on a Monday morning and comes back on a Friday night, and his wife and two kids, his wife works also,
okay.
but they're all, and he came, his parents worked in the pharmaceutical industry and chemistry, and also in academia, and so he knew a huge amount about pharmaceutical chemistry as a graduate student,
okay.
but it was just a pleasure to work with too. And during that time, there were two postdocs. So John Yates is the person who really worked out discovering the origin of synthesis of EBV. And he then went to Roswell Park. He's subsequently retired. And a person with whom I've collaborated ever since, Wolfgang Hammerschmidt, who came here as a postdoc and now is a faculty member in Munich.
Okay.
But we've gone hiking together. 10 times maybe all over the world, literally, and published two papers together 4 or 5 months ago.
Okay.
So
okay.
he's a pure pleasure. And it's funny, colleagues whom you get to know personally, at least in my case, are the ones whom I can collaborate with most easily because I trust them.
Right.
Honestly. Other students back, I mean, I'm still in the 80s. You know, I haven't progressed to be in the 90s. So other students, Dave Reisman began as a technician in this lab, and then wanted to be a graduate student. I said, don't come to this lab. Go, you know, get some breath. Go. And he went to another lab for a year and said he was unhappy. So then he came to this, back to this lab as a graduate student. So he's a faculty member at the University of South Carolina, and he's a delightful person too. And among the things I can describe is he went and postdoced in Israel. His wife is Israeli. And they were there at one of the times, whatever Arab country was sending rockets over. So he was in Tel Aviv.
Okay.
So they all had to get gas masks. And he had a big beard. Turns out you can't put a big anyway.
Well,
it survived, and that was fine.
I
really mean it. It's an extended family.
Yeah,
so
it sounds like it. Yeah,
it's just quite marvelous. And you know, as much as I watched them grow up, they I'm sure have watched me grow up and change. And so they influence me and Donata. I mean, they helped raise Arthur, our son. not this group, it was the next group. Because
okay.
Arthur was born in 85, but the students who were here in the 90s, I'll just give one story, two of them, Tim and Dave, came up to me at some point and said, you know, we really worry about you as being a father. And I said, okay, why? Well, we don't think you spend enough time with Arthur. Can we teach him how to play soccer? I said, are you kidding? That's a great idea. Go for it. Yeah. So I am sure in part that's why he is in science, not just because Donut and I are in it, but because there's, I mean, he had lived in the lab. And,
okay.
You know, he was this young person around adults, adults. And they adopted him.
Okay.
So at another point, by this time he was a teenager, and Ajimeni took him out. I can't remember. This may have been after Aj's graduation. There was some celebration. And we all went out together, and then Donato and I went home, and Arthur stayed with the younger crew. And they went to some place where they were smoking hookahs. And this was, you can imagine for a teenager, this was fantastic.
Yeah.
And so there were lovely occasions.
Okay.
And so it is like an extended
family.
Right,
right. That's great. So what does he do, Arthur, now?
So he is married. He is a postdoc at Harvard. His
okay.
wife is a postdoc at Brown.
Okay.
He is in a neuroscience lab. She is in an applied mathematics, so she really is a mathematician.
Okay.
And her applied mathematics is aimed at developing algorithms that allows her to identify what are called the genes that are mutated through genetic sweeps. So imagine if there were to be a gene that would give rise to resistance to HIV,
mm-hmm.
that in a few generations, it would be a very popular gene, and it would spread rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
So there are such genes that have been selected for in us. Identifying them is non-trivial, in part just because there are so many mutations that arise that have little or no consequences,
mm-hmm.
but they can go along for the ride. So somehow figuring out what gives this selective advantage is non-trivial. So she's been working on that.
Hmm.
And
interesting.
He works on, actually, something to do with trying to understand satiety. The approach is not so obvious. So you imagine you can take a little bit of the skull of a mouse off and put
mm-hmm.
a piece of plastic there. That you can engineer that mouse so that a subset of the neurons, when they are active, for the moment of the pulse of nervous information that flows down them, turn green. And that greenness is on for about 100 milliseconds. And what he's doing is following about 250 of these cells for a couple of hours, where he's trained these mice to respond to food cues or not.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to ask, when they aren't actually being given these cues, do they then recall what was happening? What were the stimuli that led to being fed?
Mm-hmm.
Something of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all an attempt to understand really what fosters satiety in us, what makes us hungry.
Okay.
So it's a very different world, but it's not so far away from what Donato works on.
Okay.
So Arthur and I have published two papers together.
Oh, you have? Oh,
my
gosh.
And we have submitted and are rewriting a third paper together.
Wow.
With other people. So,
okay.
But
just you and him, or your wife too?
No. Donut's not on these. But he, as an only child, is very much worried that he somehow is unfair, unequal in his association with each of us.
Uh-huh.
So he definitely is trying to publish with her. I mean, Don and I laugh about this because normally, you know, if you're parents of multiple children, you worry about being fair to each of them.
Right.
He's
right.
worried about being
yeah.
fair to each of
yeah.
his parents.
Yeah.
But it's a real pleasure because it turns out he's very smart and
yeah.
he can do things that I can't do at all. He's very good at computational work and I'm not at all.
Okay. Did he go to school here or
no,
college?
He went to Wesleyan, which
okay.
is in Connecticut. There are multiple Wesleyans. The one he went
oh,
to.
Oh, okay. Didn't know that.
Well, they're all founded by the Methodist Church, and they're named
okay.
after John Wesley, who was somebody may have started a Methodist church, I'm not sure.
Okay.
And the one in Connecticut is, so I went to Harvard. He got such a better education than I did. It's mind-boggling. And it's small. Can I tell you a funny story?
Sure,
go ahead. Okay. So I do talk with each of the students in the lab once a week formally, as
mm-hmm.
you and I are speaking.
Mm-hmm.
But when he was away in college, whomever I was speaking knew that if Arthur called, I would tend to say, can I take some time? And they would just sit there and I would talk to Arthur. Anyway, I get this phone call. Dad, I just took the best exam I've ever taken. I haven't told you this. And I first thought, I've never taken an exam that I'm positive about in my entire life. I said, oh, really? What's it? He was majoring in psychology.
Okay.
And he said, well, it was in astronomy. I said, okay. Why? What made it so good? And he said, well, it was exciting to try to answer these questions. And so he switched into astronomy, and to switch into astronomy, he had to switch into physics, so he did that too.
Oh, my gosh.
And when he finished college, the person who had been his mentor in astronomy left Wesleyan and went to become a chair at Indiana. So
uh-huh.
Arthur went with him as a technician, not
okay.
as a student. And I think loved everything he did with one exception. Today, if you are an astronomer, you're in a room that is about 1/4 this size, and you have a computer that's about 10 times that size, because everything you get comes off, it's images from a CCD camera.
Uh-huh.
The big telescopes are, you don't go and use them yourself. You write grants that might get you 7 days
okay.
in the year on that telescope. And
okay.
you pray the weather is good. And you tell them, point the telescope to such and such a place in the sky and send me your images.
Uh-huh.
That's what happens. And
okay.
then you write computer programs to analyze that data to address some question.
Okay.
That's it. That's what he was doing. And it turns out, even though he is Donatas and my son, he's very social.
Okay.
And this is not, maybe because he grew up with all the kids in the lab. But, this was not a social profession. That was one problem. The second
right.
problem was, well, at Wesleyan, he had met his future wife, and he was damned if he wasn't going to be where she was, and she was a graduate student at Brown.
Okay.
So, never having had any biology, he applied to be in the biology program at Brown and came here and took one course, and that was Genetics 560.
Okay.
465, whatever it was. It's the advanced undergraduate course in genetics, and for that summer, and which was great for Donato and me because he was around, and on the basis of that, he was accepted at Brown. Actually, on the basis of the things he had done in astronomy, and his whatever GREs, I guess. So he went to Brown as a graduate student.
Wow.
And eventually ended up doing something not so far away from what Donato does.
Okay. And is she's not in this department?
She's
your wife.
Chair of neuroscience.
Neuroscience, okay.
Yeah.
And so what's her name? You said earlier she was from Germany, so Donata is her first
Donata
name?
Donata is her first name. O-E-R-T-E-L is her last name.
Okay.
Her father is, at the age of 96, a retired professor of geology.
Okay.
And had the typical German education, so after Greek and Latin, and
okay.
German and English and French and Portuguese and one Indian language.
Oh my gosh.
But he's old enough to have been in the war
uh-huh.
and got his degree just at the end of the war, or just after the war, obviously not at the end, and went to, so why Donata? That's how it began. Because it's the, God, I'm going to screw this up. Perfect participle of well given.
I was going to say, it sounds like something was giving, yeah.
Yes.
So
oh, yeah.
That's what it, okay.
And Ortel is German, but it is old for oarsmith, I think, is how it could be translated in some
okay.
of its origins.
Okay. I don't know that.
So he grew up both in Austria and in Germany. She grew up in Bonn until she was, how old were they? I think they went to Portugal when she was about 4 or 5.
Oh, okay.
Then they went to India, to Goa, and only at 9 did they come to this country.
They came here,
at
okay,
9.
Okay. And you met here? Because I was wondering if you met at the Karolinska.
We met here.
Okay.
She had she had been married to an Englishman, divorced, lived in Germany with her grandfather, gone to graduate school at Santa Barbara in neuroscience, came here as a postdoc.
Okay.
And I had just come a year before as an assistant professor, and somebody who knew each of us held a party and, and as they told us later, invited 19 camouflages.
Oh.
It was a very thoughtful gesture on their part,
right.
We both think. So that's quite lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And then, by the way, within 5 months of our being married, she left to go to Harvard as a postdoc for another 2 years.
Oh, boy.
That was good, though.
Okay.
It was good because among the marvelous things that happened is that she recognized that it was then the mecca for neuroscience
uh-huh.
in the world.
Uh-huh.
And she was every bit as competent as they were.
She was what?
Every bit as competent as
oh,
they were.
Oh, every bit
and
as
that's
competent.
A very, you know, particularly for women.
Right.
Particularly
right.
back then.
Right.
You've got to know that.
Yeah.
There ain't nothing superhuman about them. They're not different.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very powerful thing to know.
Okay.
So it was a very good experience. And
yeah.
we had very expensive phone bills. That's okay, too.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, interesting. Unusual name, for sure.
Yes.
I mean,
well,
mentioned.
Try my last one. I mean, Segment's not particularly useful either.
Right.
my mother would say it's not a name, it's an affliction. So, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so let's see. So are there any research awards that you would like to mention, either your own or of the lab as a group?
There's one that I'm proud of, and that's because I just respect the institution, and that's the American Cancer Society.
Mm.
So I hold what's called an American Cancer Society research professorship.
Okay, right, right. I think
and it did provide money for 10 years, so it provides nothing but that name. On the other hand, during that 10-year period in particular, I would go and give lots of talks for the ACS.
Uh-huh.
And it's amazing. Some of them were Florida and California, but most of them were around Madison,
mm-hmm.
within 100 miles. The places I would go were often to just thank the people who donated to the ACS for these runs for life.
Okay, right, right.
And I can remember going several times to Wild Rose, Wisconsin, which is a tiny town, maybe 60 or 70 miles north of here.
Okay.
They stand out as giving more money per capita than any other town in America at a given average income. So ACS ranks, I mean, if you're from New York City, your income is different.
Uh-huh.
But within that setting,
mm-hmm.
they're extraordinarily generous. And it was embarrassing how appreciative they
mm-hmm.
were of what we collectively do.
Okay.
So that was a marvelous part, too.
Yeah.
I have something from the university, which is once had some money associated with it, and it's the James Miller Professorship.
Okay.
But what is impressive about that is not me and not really the money. It's James Miller. So he was, it's in honor of him.
He was one of the Millers that used to be,
exactly.
Okay.
And he's just an incredibly lovely person.
Okay.
And a very fine scientist.
Okay.
So that's very nice too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. All right, so then this was kind of the research piece. A couple questions about UW. Why did you decide to stay here for your entire career? I'm sure some of it had to do with the dual academic career juggling that goes on and that you both had good positions here.
Yes, so there are definite positive reasons to stay here, in addition to which it's not only a nice place to live, it's a great place to raise a child.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something else too, and it really goes back to why did I come here initially?
Mm-hmm.
So when I was in Sweden looking for jobs, I came here and in 21 days gave 11 job seminars. I was tired and it didn't. And
you got 11 job offers.
I did.
I remember that. I was just like, what?
oh
my gosh.
But of all those places, there was only one place that really cared about
cancer.
And I mean that. And that
yeah.
was this place. And that's what I wanted to work on.
Right.
And that's not true now. I mean, a
right.
lot of these other institutions have genuine cancer research departments, and they really do it, and they can maybe do it better than we do, but this place cared about it from the start.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel an allegiance to it.
Mm-hmm.
I also I love working with graduate students. They are an extended family. And
mm-hmm.
in most of the more, I don't say more competitive, but say in the research competitive environments tend to be run by postdocs or run on postdocs. Well, I work with some superb postdocs. But I think the opportunity to work with young people at the graduate level is probably here as rich as it is anywhere in America. That's not quite true with postdocs. They tend to go to the East and West Coast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
More money, more something or another.
Sure.
More fad,
mm-hmm.
honestly.
Mm-hmm.
And the pleasure that both Donata and I derive from the people we work with has made this place a marvelous place to be,
mm-hmm.
honestly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I'm here.
Okay.
And yeah, we have had other job opportunities, and it has been possible for both of us to move, and neither of us have chosen to do so. And we, in fact, generally don't go and tell the people above us that's what we're considering,
uh-huh,
which
uh-huh.
is another way to get money from, because I just don't like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of people do that.
Right, right, sure. Okay, so how different is the campus today compared to 1975? I guess there's physical, like,
yeah.
you know, I'm sure a lot of buildings have
changed.
Yeah,
yes.
been built. And you've only been here for 2 years, is that right?
In this one. Yes.
And so the other one was over by lot 20, is that correct?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
exactly.
where my husband is,
yes.
so I see the sign there.
Sure,
yeah.
sure. So we were, that's the building I came to
right.
in 70, for his first year in 74.
Okay.
Because yeah, I interviewed here.
Yeah.
But, so it's changed enormously physically, and largely I'm unaware of it because it's gradual.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's true for anyone.
Right,
anybody.
Right.
If you look at pictures of the way it was. But then in other respects, how has it changed? There are still about the same number of students.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yes.
Okay.
I think there are 32,000 undergraduate, maybe another something on the order of 10,000 graduate of all flavors.
That sounds like, yeah, 42,000 total, yeah.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask how much has the administration grown 3 to 5 times,
mm-hmm.
I find that phenomenal. Now, is that necessary? I can't judge. I can say that in part it reflects state and federal government regulations,
mm-hmm.
and people have to do something about them. So there's a huge change in just the number of people who are in administration
right.
throughout the university. I think that there is a change in the extent to which we teach and what the role is of faculty in teaching at this institution, and that teaching is less important than it once was. That's certainly true in the medical school. But I sense that's true in many departments, not all, but
mm-hmm.
in the sciences, quite generally, that more and more of our existence depends on the success of research, and that means federal dollars, largely.
Mm-hmm.
For engineering, it's going to mean private dollars, too,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know that as well. So that teaching tends now to be done more and more by people who are not faculty,
mm-hmm.
but lecturers, for
uh-huh.
example.
Right.
That's not true in this department, but it's sure true in other departments I know about. And that's a precarious life for lecturers, and the recompense is much less than for the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
The faculty still are recompensed much less than in equally peer institutions. So I worry about this university, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And the other differences are the composition of graduate students has changed enormously.
Huh?
So one of the things Howard in, I don't know, 77, 78, something like that, I remember being visited by people from China as just it was opening up.
Mm-hmm.
And they were particularly keen on getting to know him because he had was associated with this revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they revolution. And the revolution and the understanding that information flows from RNA to DNA,
yeah.
not just DNA to RNA. But there was no one on campus from China, or almost no one.
Oh, okay, right,
and
yes.
And now the number of students who come, both as undergraduates, but particularly as graduate students, is enormous.
It's enormous, that's true, yes.
So there are huge change in the demographics
mm-hmm.
of students
mm-hmm.
in this university, particularly at the graduate student. Which is both delightful for someone like me because I get to meet people from all over the world,
but it's a little bit scary in the following sense. If our success in research is going to be dependent on the federal government footing the bill, and it is, and our influence with the federal government is affected by our composition, and fewer of us are going to be here, because a lot of people are going to go back to the countries, or fewer of us are perceived as being American, we're going to have less influence in Congress and the Senate, and it'll be harder to get funding. So I'm scared about that.
Yeah.
So, but personally, it's quite marvelous.
Mm-hmm.
But I worry about the future of funding medical research unless we have a lot of people who are domestic driving the funding and driving the research.
Okay.
We'll see what happens. I may not see it. You may see it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. All right. So that's quite a few changes. So then, just in terms of anecdotes, we talked about how we're trying to stop people from smoking, and that was a little anecdote over at Union South. Are there any other things like that that come to mind that might have, I mean, it sounds like, well, you came in 75. It sounds like the 60s and I guess into the 70s, you know, Madison's pretty liberal. There was a lot of sort of political, I mean, was that... By the time you got here, was that kind of slowing down, or are there any other things, or just changes in campus culture, I guess, that you may have noticed?
I mean, I think there's been a disengagement in politics that's dramatic, but that's throughout the country. That's not just in this university. And do I see other changes? Well, you know, sure, there are changes. One of the things that was obvious when I came here is that first, many of the staff were farmers, and many of the young people, students, came from farms. There's a different kind of, that's a different background.
Right.
People now, Don still works on a farm and works here, and he's in his 80s, but most people don't know what it is to live and work on a farm that are here. But I used to work on a farm, so I can I have some feeling for what that's like. That's a huge difference, actually, because it says something about rural Wisconsin almost having fewer representatives here than it once had. And that's a little worrisome, too, because a lot of Wisconsin remains rural. Now, the university as a whole, through extension, has contact with people all over the state, but Madison is probably more and more distant from rural Wisconsin. And since it is the flagship, that's its
essence. Right.
And I think that's a real, again, a potential concern for how we're viewed across the state. So when I came here, there were people who, in genetics, for example, who had been instrumental in developing the strains of alfalfa that are grown throughout Wisconsin. Well, that contribution means a hell of a lot to people who grow alfalfa. But things like that probably aren't associated with Madison now as they once were 40 years ago. And that probably makes our position with respect to state funding more precarious. And we're not funded particularly much at all by the state, but you know, every little bit helps. So that's a problem I think we face. And that's a change in culture, in effect, not of the sort from the 60s to today, but a different change. And that will be a change as more and more undergrads come from abroad. And
I was going to say that goes hand in hand with what you were saying earlier with the greater international population and perhaps less of a domestic or Wisconsin specific.
And clearly the drive to have some undergrads from abroad is they pay more.
So
may not be fair to them, but that's the way that the whole thing works.
Was the Wisconsin idea something that this particular department bought into and contributed to?
I think definitely.
In
different ways, but here's one. I can remember Betty Miller, probably in the late 70s, and this surely should be reflected by the Wisconsin idea, going and speaking multiple times in front of the at the State House. So, in the to the local representatives about how they should not adopt some of the federal standards for anything from radiation safety, and I'll give you another one that's really striking, other chemical safety, also asbestos.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now why? Because surely you want to be safe. Well, it turns out that a lot of the federal legislation at that time was written for, say, chemical industry that might make 100,000 liters of a solvent.
Mm-hmm.
So what their safety standards, if you try to translate it when you're working with a liter of the stuff, makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it would have made the sort of research we do here almost impossible.
Okay.
So she was taking her knowledge of the explicit law and trying to educate representatives from all over Wisconsin
mm-hmm.
about, don't do this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one place they failed was in asbestos.
Hmm.
Now, why does that matter? Because you sure don't want to die of some asbestos-induced form of, it's not quite lung cancer, it's pleural cancer. Well, it turns out asbestos can cause cancer. It is solid state cancer, meaning it's not going to change your genetics. How it actually does so is not so clear. But what is clear is, as Gertrude Stein said about a rose, not quite, asbestos is not asbestos, it's not asbestos.
Hmm.
So there are different crystalline forms
okay.
of asbestos.
Okay.
Only one of them gives rise to the fragments that are of the dimensions of a cell, say about 10 microns, 5 microns in length.
Mm-hmm.
That's carcinogenic. All of the other crystalline forms of asbestos don't.
Okay.
Guess what's in most of the buildings in Wisconsin? Not that which is carcinogenic.
Oh, okay.
So we have spent billions of dollars removing from housing something that has no carcinogenic risk at all, because rather than calling it asbestos of a particular crystalline type,
mm-hmm.
they call it asbestos.
Oh, okay.
Well, does that make sense? No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
She was, did she fail? Yes. But did she try? Yes.
Okay.
So, I would say that's a kind of a Wisconsin,
right.
Whatever it is, ideal.
Ideal,
and
right,
really
right.
Lived
yeah.
up to it.
Yeah. All right, I think we're almost through here. So teaching, sounds like you've noted a number of changes. So have you always just done graduate teaching?
No.
You've done undergrad.
I've taught undergrads, I've taught nurses, I've taught medical students,
and
I've taught graduate students.
So it sounds like I'm still kind of stunned, even though you said that it's not really part of your job description, you've done so much of it.
Oh, I've taught a huge amount.
Yeah.
Well, I'm at a university.
Yeah.
The mere fact that it's not part of the job description is, pardon me, irrelevant.
Yeah.
And that's another way we as a department influence the university.
Uh-huh.
We have taught a lot. I used to be amazed because a number of people in other departments, particularly on the other side when we were up yonder, complain about nobody in McArdle ever teaching and what an easy life we had. And we, Norman and I, went through and figured out how many hours of didactic teaching did we do
uh-huh.
on average, and we were the highest among any of the basic sciences in the medical school.
Wow.
At least at the time we looked it up.
Right.
Or as V.J. Bashwal used to say, a lie told 100 times becomes the truth. Surely, for the first 20 years or so I was here, it was expected that we teach independent of. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's still expected that we teach in that you will not come, if you go up for tenure without adequate teaching, you will not get tenure.
Okay.
But I maintain that that's wrong if, in fact, we're not recompensed for teaching
mm-hmm.
and it's not appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
Because, look, I might do it, but the way something is appreciated professionally in this country, largely, is money.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not going to pay us to do it, and we're expected, in effect, to get all of our salaries from federal grants, that's a contradiction that's inappropriate.
Right.
And I think that just stems from a lack of agreement between the medical school and other schools.
Hmm.
And in the long run, it will have to change, but in the short run, it hasn't. And the short run is glacially slow in academia.
Uh-huh.
So it's not going to change in
okay.
the next decade, but I'm sure it will in the next three decades.
Right.
So,
would you say the tenure process itself has changed during your time here?
In a lot of ways, sure. Things like mentoring committees really aiming to help assistant professors understand what's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were no such things as mentoring committees. And an awareness that there's an increasing requirement in some schools for faculty to pay their own salaries.
Mm-hmm.
Well, gradually that's got to change what's evaluated in tenure, and so teaching does matter less, though it matters.
Right.
Service matters less than it once did. So there, you know, it used to be we had to do three things. We had to teach, we had to perform service for the university, and we had to do research.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably of those three, in this department, research was from its beginning the most important, but the other two were definitely important, both at a national level for service and teaching locally.
Mm-hmm.
They're less important now. So there are differences. At some level, there's a much greater emphasis in the medical school for clinical faculty and for basic sciences to do research together. It used to be we taught together, now that's disappearing. So all of that will be reflected in what's required for tenure, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are changes.
Is there any service activity that stands out for you, where you felt like...
For years, it comes in different flavors. I still am the PI on the departmental training grant. And I have been at that for 25 to 30 years.
Oh my gosh.
Long time. That's a kind of a service because I have graduate students, but none is paid on that training grant. It has taken, over the years, a substantial effort on my part to keep it going.
Sure.
I chaired our graduate student program for, 25 years or so.
Wow.
And I still am, I'm reasonably heavily involved in that. That's a kind of service.
Okay.
I was Norman Schofer. When Norman was the director and the chair, I was the associate director.
Okay.
And that's a kind of service too, because Norman is, I think, a superb administrator and is a micromanager and didn't want me to do a damn thing. But what he wanted me to do is to sit, and we had lunch every day together.
Okay.
He'd be in that chair and I'd be in this chair.
Every day, oh my.
Yes, every day. And when things went awry, which they often do, he would be furious, and he'd be furious at me.
Okay.
And my duty was to let him vent. And at the end of this 20, 30, 40 minutes, depending on how much venting there was, he was relieved and he'd go back and be a superb administrator. And I'm only slightly exaggerating.
Yeah.
There was a massive amount of that.
Okay.
And at that time, I took care of the graduate students and funding and all of that for the graduate students, but he did everything else.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Wow. The training grant, is that like a T32? Did changes in the higher level administration have a significant effect ever on your career, or were you sufficiently removed for that?
You mean higher above chair?
Mm-hmm. Like dean?
Not much. There have been a number of committees where I've been involved in identifying or deans, I guess.
Like search committee?
Yeah, but I don't recall any of that. Or no, I think that I've been rather insulated. Donato, my spouse, is chair of neuroscience, definitely deals with the dean a lot, and the associate dean, and both respects each of them enormously, and I think the relationship is mutually beneficial. I think she's pretty damn good at what she does, but I really have been insulated from that.
More insulated. Yep. Same with the chancellor, like, Have you felt effects of different chancellors of the bigger entity?
Well, I respect the current one very much. They varied, in my opinion, in competence. And
okay.
I think this person is very sharp and knows how both to deal with the orneriness of the people above her and the orneriness of the people below her very effectively.
Uh-huh.
So I think she's marvelous.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I get to meet the chancellors or have gotten to meet the chancellors in various capacities, but never in a way that is highly personal.
Uh-huh.
It's always there are 20 other people in the room,
right.
And you're
right.
An audience more than anything else.
Right.
The one person among them all, the one that impressed me for her personal attention was, I'm not going to remember her name, but it will come back to me eventually. She was here in 82, 83, 84 and became
Donna Shalaya?
Yeah.
Okay.
She was very good one-on-one with people.
Okay.
And the reason I know that is a person who had been a postdoc in the department with Dick Burgess, who was very competent, moved to become a faculty member in bacteriology. Her name's Carol Gross. And Carol was considering leaving to go to UCSF, where she is now.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember Donna Shalala, and she was lived across the street, and by this time she was divorced, and we all, you know, when she would come over for dinner, etc.
Okay.
So she was part of this extended family.
Okay.
And Donna Gross drives up in her peculiar looking car and gets out on a Saturday or a Sunday, and they're just talking. And I thought, you know, if you want to retain faculty, that's the way to do it. And Carol was very successful, and clearly there weren't all that many women who were so prominent in biology
uh-huh.
at that time on campus.
Right.
And so Donna was doing her part,
yeah,
which was lovely to see,
right.
Actually.
Right.
But again, I've been insulated from all of that.
Yeah. So. Well, it sounds like she was the chancellor, though, that you probably did get to meet the most as far as... Since she lived across the street, etc.
Oh, no, she didn't live across the street, excuse me.
Oh,
Carol,
that was
Rose
Carol.
Right.
Carol, oh, I see.
She,
but you
yeah.
saw Donna. Oh, okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. All right. So, last question. What will it take for UW to remain one of the top public research universities? Money, obviously. That's always the big one, right? And you've talked a little bit about the
sure.
issues with that.
But the money is not going to come from the state, first
mm-hmm.
of all. I think that the institution in first fostering and then being fostered by Wharf is truly impressive.
Hmm.
But the money from Wharf alone is not going to make it enough.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to be more competitive, at least in the biological sciences, in getting grants from the federal government through NIH or
mm-hmm.
NSF, and that is particularly perilous for the future, because we have no idea how the next administration
mm-hmm.
is going to do anything with respect
right.
to NIH funding. And can we have closer ties with biological industries, pharmaceutical companies, for example? As far as I can tell, that's never been a long-standing way to fund academic research. So I don't know if you know this, but in the 70s, 80s, a couple of big pharmaceutical firms made alliances, with Harvard's the one I know about, but there were some on the West Coast, some on the East Coast, where they really invested a hell of a lot of money into them by our standards.
Okay.
And the investment was a quid pro quo. We invest in you, but we have the first rights to patent anything
okay.
that you guys do.
Okay.
And they all withdrew in the end.
Hmm.
So it was an injection of capital, but not a sustained one.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think industry is going to support us either. I think we're going to have to get it from the federal government. We're going to have to be more competitive,
mm-hmm.
which is a little scary, because a lot of us, most of us, work quite hard. But I don't have an answer. I really don't. I think one of the strengths that this department has had historically, and maybe this university had historically, is we had a lot of people who were involved in making decisions at the NIH level. So people like the Millers were very involved in NIH, and that then allowed us to either conform better to what their expectations were, or in some cases probably mold their expectations to conform to what we could do. And I mean that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Millers were they were very impressive scientists. Howard also, in being involved in NIH, were influential.
Right.
We don't have that now. That's selfish for this department.
Yeah.
And that's in part because now there are many, many, many more departments of cancer research.
Mm-hmm.
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 We need more of that, I think. And more of that has to be appreciated by the university as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it can't come from people of my age. It has to come from a younger generation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So would you say you're a little bit pessimistic at this point as far as...
Well, I am in the following sense. I love what I do. I love being able to train people to do it similarly. But I think that the changes that I see, even in what the students want, they don't want to do what I do in general. I am a rare bird.
Uh-huh.
And what that means is there have to be changes in the department, but in the biological sciences in general, to conform better to either what the students want to do, or which is then it's not going to be so much research-based. And yeah, I am pessimistic about then.
Mm-hmm.
Because too many of the students, from my opinion, want to go do something other than what I do. Well, if they don't want to do what I do, then I'm not the best person to train them.
Mm-hmm.
And we're being paid on training grants to train people to do what I do. So there's a real contradiction between the goals of many of the graduate students and the goals of the people who fund us to train those graduate students.
I see.
And that's come about in part because this profession is viewed as being too hard,
mm-hmm.
too unyielding,
mm-hmm.
too bad for family life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, Donata and I had one child. I was 40, she was 38. Arif was born on a Monday. She was tenured on that Friday.
Jeez.
And she was tenured early.
Okay.
So, you know, you say that to most people, they say, you're crazy.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah, of course, at some level we are, but we love what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm a little bit pessimistic. But I must admit, given the elections, I think many people are.
Right, right, yeah.
I mean, the country will weather it, but we're not going to be the same country 4 years from now, let alone 8 years from now.
Oh, I know. Well, please.
Yes.
I can't.
Well,
yeah, all right. Okay, well, I think we've covered a lot of ground. Thank you so much for
it's
your time,
pleasure.
For being so generous. Rayla, if I wanted to kind of speak with her, does she have her UW address still? Do you know?
She does.
Okay.
She does. I don't think she comes to genetics much
okay.
at all, but I think she does.
Okay.
And she'll have an email address for that too.
Okay,
yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. And she'll come across probably as being quite formal. She's an incredibly lovely person, though. And how she wants very much to protect Howard's memory and that of her children. So
uh-huh.
how, if she were to view an interview as being invading of that privacy, she would be
right.
recalcitrant.
Right.
But she's a very lovely person.
Okay.
So, and I think I've known her since 1974. Three. Two.
Oh, my.
One. So 1971.
Oh.
She, Howard and Rayla, Howard taught a course in Cold Spring Harbor when I was a graduate student.
That's
here.
Right. That's, I think I asked you how you met him, and so that's when you met her too? Okay.
So they brought the kids. And I remember one or both had pink eye. So it was
oh,
a very
geez.
Difficult time for her as the mom.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I will see. I'll touch base with Troy probably in the new year and see where else we want to take this. So, and I've been thinking about, I can hand it off.